Mr. Guthrie Rainfall.
Nice birds to watch, because I like bird watching, and there's a little bit of rowing around from these islands and looking at the lovely gardens, although they were shabby at that time, at Tresco and so on. So that was enjoyable. And then there came a time when we were all shifted back to the mainland. I suppose they thought we'd done enough square bashing and learning the elements of the basics of infantry warfare on the Scillies, and we were shipped back to the mainland, and we moved along the coast to various places doing training and so on. And then one day a little note came round saying, anybody interested in joining Special Operations Executive in Special Operations, please fill in a questionnaire and your name and address and so on. And I thought, well, that would be better, because really, although I enjoyed the Scillies, I didn't enjoy the officer's mess. I thought it was terrible, actually. It's not my kind of life.
In what way?
Oh, well, first of all, there was the regimentalness of it, you know, the seniority. And then they were so childish. Every day after dinner, we used to play games in the mess, the sort of games I gave up when I was 14. One I remember particularly, where you blindfolded everybody was blindfolded, and then they got a rolled up newspaper and hit each other. And of course, what happened was, whenever the colonel was being hit, we all took our blindfolds off and saw exactly where he was and bashed him, because we really didn't like him very much. That's not soldiering. That's not beginning to save the prisoners from the concentration camps in Germany and so on. And it really seemed so remote from anything that I wanted to do. That I didn't like. I'm not by nature a regimented kind of person. And that is why, I suppose, SOE appealed to me, apart from the fact that it sort of fell into my lap in a way. Anyhow, we had this note saying, if you're interested, please sign on the dotted line. And I signed on the dotted line, and then I went up for a board somewhere or other and told them my history. Say somewhere or other in Baker Street, or I'm not sure where it was in London. These details rather disappear. It's a long time ago that it all happened. And they asked me what languages I spoke. And I truthfully said I spoke a little bad French. And they noticed that in my curriculum vitae, I had spent a couple of years when I first left school in the Ionian Bank in London. So they immediately thought I knew something about Greece, which I didn't, except I sort of vaguely knew the geography of Greece, because I knew where the bank had different branches. And they said, would I like to go to Greece? And I thought, well, that would be nice. And I said, yes, I'd like to go to Greece. So I was shipped off to Cairo on the way to Greece. And there I was supposed to learn some Greek. We learned a little, I suppose, a few odd words, which I've now forgotten. And we learned a little bit about the Middle East. And then we went to Palestine, as it was then called, and we were taught how to blow things up. And this was fascinating. I liked blowing things up, so we made lots of bangs. and I learned how to drive a railway engine, which hasn't ever proved very useful to me. But it was nice to know. I've forgotten again. And I was thinking, when I remember that they were, we were taught all the things that the Israelis did against us a few years later. But that's the way things happen. And then one day, just before Christmas, they said I had to go back home. A little notice saying back to UK. And I went to the head commanding officer, said, why have I got to go back to UK, please, sir? And he said, well, we're not sending any more British officers into Greece. All they do now is to fight each other, the pro-communists and the anti-communists, and they forget about the Germans. Right, whether he's right or wrong, I don't know, but we're not sending any more British officers into Greece, and we see that you speak a little French, so you're going back to England with a view to going to France. So back to England I came, and we went to a house called Milton Hall, which is near Peterborough, which was one of these big houses taken over for the war effort. And we did more training there. We were partly American, partly British, of course, partly American, and partly French, Dutch, Danish, and so on. And towards the end of our training time, we were put into teams, which consisted of one British or American, one native of the country we were going to, in my case French, and one radio operator who was an NCO and could be any of those nationalities. He could be British, he could be American, he could be, in my case, French, which is what he was. And then on the I was, I think, literally, my team, which consisted of a Frenchman, French wireless operator, and myself, were the first team to go of this special unit, which was codenamed Jedbra.
What was the name of your team?
Harry.
Can you remember the names of the people who went with you?
Yes, the code names I can remember. French officer was a Gapo. He was a seminarist. He was trained to be a priest. Nice young man, quite jolly, and not what one would think of perhaps as a seminarist. He was killed afterwards in the Southeast Asia. And the wireless operator had a code name of Centime, and I had a code name of Denby. Why I wanted a code name, I don't know, but it quite amused me to have a code name. So I was called Denby, like the China, or the place, that's it. And the team was called Harry. And on D-Day evening, we left in an aeroplane from some unknown airport to a dropping zone, a DZ, in central France, together with two SAS officers who, so to speak, went with us for the lift, for the ride. I don't mean that in any denigratory sort of way, but they were going out and they were setting up a camp or something, so they came, we were in our plane with us, and it was a Hudson. And to my mind, the great blessing of a Hudson is that they're pretty, even in those days, they were pretty ropey planes, but the jump, so-called, was a chute, a slide, and you sat at the top of the slide, and when they said go, you didn't have to jump out of the plane, you just put your legs together on the slide and slid. And that required the least effort and the least initiative, so to speak. There was nothing you could do about it. You went. And I can't pretend for a moment that I enjoyed jumping. I thought it was absolutely terrible. But there we are. We did it. And just before we arrived at the DZ, the message came back from the pilot. He was awfully sorry he couldn't find the point we were supposed to be jumping, and he was going to go home. So I sent a message back, come off it. Does he know where he is? He knows where he is, but he can't see the DZ. So I said, well, nobody's meeting us. I don't want to go through all this again. Let's go and tell us where we're going to land, and it doesn't matter if it's not quite the right place. I'm sure that was the right thing to do under any circumstances, certainly because I didn't want to go to do this all again.
What was the date of this?
The date?
Yes.
This was the evening of D-Day. Right?
Right.
I don't know what?
5th of June.
5th of June. Was that D-Day?
D-Day was the 6th of June.
Well, it was the 6th, no, it was the 6th, I think. The evening of, not the evening before D-Day, the evening of D-Day. But, I mean, it was all one big thing then. D-Day was sort of extended. We were to make contact with someone when we arrived, but not at the DZ, somewhere else. So it didn't really matter whether we went from the DZ that we were told to, or from another one, as long as it wasn't too far away. So he said, all right, he'd drop us there, and he'd tell us exactly where it was, and he did, and we jumped there. I was the senior officer at the, in the plane, and we jumped, or if you like, slid down our slides there and arrived safely on the ground. We did all our drill of burying our parachutes and so on. We couldn't find Santim for some time. He turned up next day. He got carried away in the breeze or something. And we couldn't find some of our equipment, which was in separate containers with their own parachutes. And it appeared that those had Roman candled. You know, the parachutes hadn't opened, and they'd come down, whop, like that. So glad it was the equipment and not me. And the two of our radio sets were no use at all. But Santim managed with another radio set or fixed up the summer or other. He got through when he turned up. And we then proceeded to go to this bridge where we were to meet this contact, who was a chap in the Mackie. It was quite a hike from there. And we it took us some time. They always say that jumping is the equivalent, I don't know how true this is, but it was said in those days anyhow, it's the equivalent of losing 24 hours, losing a night's sleep. And we had lost a night's sleep anyhow because we'd been in the plane, and then we'd walked quite a long way during the next night, so that we had lost quite a lot of sleep and we were pretty tired. And by the time we got down to this bridge, we also had some heavy equipment to carry, far too heavy, and the SAS had even more equipment to carry than we did. We dumped our equipment on the way somewhere and said we'll come back for this, and we went on and arrived at this bridge over the River Kür, where we were supposed to see this chap.
Where is this, the River Kür?
It's the Morvan. Does that...
Yes.
Well, it's in the Morvan.
This is the area that joins the Massy Central to
yes.
the Vosges?
I would think probably, yes.
separates it, the southeast Paris basin from the Seine corridor.
Yes, and putting it like that, I'm not quite sure. Nearest town, Saulieu, Avallon, Auxerre, and we were in right in the midst of that. An untouristy part of France that people going down to the south whiz by without noticing. And a very lovely part, actually. Well, when we got to this bridge, we were just on time. I really was terribly tired, and I was hallucinating. I saw all sorts of things which weren't there. I remember saying to whoever it was with me, I said, "You see, there's a ballet dancer down there." And I saw a ballet dancer in a complete tights and everything, like Harlequin or something, only he was all yellow. And we discussed this between us, you know, and wonder what he's doing there. And of course it was nothing, it was a tree or a bush or something, you know. Anyhow, we got down eventually to this bridge, and this chap wasn't there. So we came back, and sort of thought, what will we do? Decided that the best thing we could do was to get Gappo, who was a Frenchman, into some kind of civilian uniform, coat and shirt, which wouldn't be anyhow uniform, wouldn't be an army uniform, so he could walk around and not look like a soldier, and send him into the village, one of the local villages, to see what was what and how he could contact the Maquis, as the our contact hadn't been there.
You were all in uniform.
We were all in uniform. Yes, the whole point of being, I should have said that perhaps, the whole point of Jedburghs was that they were in uniform, and they were to show, if nothing else, the support that they could, that the French resistance could get from London, from headquarters, with the army behind them.
You were a captain at the time, I think.
I was a captain, yes. And Gappo went in to the village, and he came back an hour or two later with a chap who was Belgian, and he said, "I've made some inquiries, and here is this chap who is going into the Maquis anyhow. Somebody's taking him in this afternoon, so he'll take us in too." So we said, "Fine, that's super." And this all happened. The boy turned up, and he took the Belgian in, and we went along with him. And the Maquis were a bit surprised to see us, because we'd arrived literally out of the blue. They had this system of message personnel on the British radio, and perhaps I better explain that. Every night, listening to the British wireless, British radio, one heard message personnel. And these were strange things, like the cats had kittens, and Uncle Tom's got a new bottle of wine, and absolutely nonsensical things. But these, we imagined, quite rightly, were messages to the resistance, and they knew that the cats had kittens meant there's some more ammunition coming, or that somebody had been killed, or whatever it was. And we all had a message personnel which we could tell people to listen for if there was any doubt as to our authenticity. And fortunately, I could say to him, "Listen tonight on the British wireless, and you will hear them say, 'Le docteur a des cheveux gris.' The doctor's got grey hair. And then you'll know that I'm okay." And Gappo had one too, I suppose. And they listened, and sure enough, the message came up, and then they knew I was all right. I say fortunately, because they decided, rightly or wrongly, that the Belgian was a plant, and they shot him in the middle of the night. And I woke up and heard shots. I thought, oh dear. But there was only just the one shot or the two shots. Next morning, I heard it was the Belgian they'd shot. And I suppose if the message personnel, mine, hadn't come through, I might have been shot too. Anyhow, they knew
I... Did you think he was a plant?
Me pardon?
Did you think he was a plant yourself?
Well, I only saw him for an hour or so. I wouldn't be surprised, I must say. He was an unattractive gentleman. But there we are. Things happen in war, don't they?
What was unattractive about him?
Oh, he was fat and greasy and that's not a reason for shooting anybody in itself. There were worse stories of that later on. Well, never mind, we haven't come to them yet. So, anyhow, I joined the Maquis and we did various things together, and I trained them in use of arms. I sent signals back to England asking for various things like ammunition and weapons and so on. And the whole time I was in France, I had a wireless operator, and he was sent signals twice a day. I only had one reply, and I must say that Brown really made me a bit annoyed. I think that they had underestimated their ability to cope with signals. Just to know that the signal had been received would have been nice. And as I say, only once it happened. And later on, I got a signal that they were going to do a massive parachute operation in my area, and they were going to drop, I forget how many, guns and jeeps and things, about 20 planes dropping things for the Maquis, for the Resistance. And I got very excited about this, and then discovered that a whole lot of German troops were being drafted into the neighborhood, and it seemed pretty likely, when I talked to the French about it, that a lot of these weapons, which were going to be dropped over the whole valley, you know, a massive thing, would get in the hands of the Germans, and I didn't think that was a very good idea. So I asked them to hold off the operation, which they did, and then I asked them a week or so later, when things were easier and the Germans weren't buzzing around in the same way, to lay it on again. They never answered. Now, this is the sort of thing that irritates one in the field, and you lose contact with headquarters, and you don't, and maybe there was some very good reason, but you certainly don't know it, and it's upsetting, to say the least. So there we were. We had various little skirmishes, and bigger skirmishes. There was a castle, a little castle, big country house, called the Chateau de Vermeaux, where we set up a hospital, or the French set up a hospital, field hospital. And I said I thought it was a rather bad place for it to be set up, because it was on the side of the road, so the access to it was very good, and you couldn't help seeing it. And difficult to get wounded people, if there were wounded people in there in the hospital, to get them out. But anyhow, they set it up there, and then a few days later, they attacked this hospital. Fortunately, we got some warning that they were going to attack it, and we managed to inflict quite a lot of injuries on the Germans. And next day...
How was that done?
Oh, we set up machine gun posts and things. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yes, round the hospital, because we saw they were doing it. And we evacuated only had about half a dozen patients, if that, at the time. We were lucky in having two or three doctors in the Mackie who had come down, and a dentist. There was a nice chubby dentist who would come and join the Mackie, and they gravitated towards our Mackie. This chubby dentist was always known as Peak Week. And he was very nice, very nice. And there was a woman doctor who did a lot of surgery with the resistance. I think they thought, well, we've got all this medical stuff, we'll have a hospital. But it wasn't a very bright way of doing it, I don't think. And we shot them up quite a lot when they came. And the next day, the Germans went to the nearest town, which was called Dun-les-Place. And they got the mayor, and the doctor, and the priest, and the borough treasurer, I suppose you'd call him, and shot them.
As reprisals?
As reprisals, yes. And that made one wonder a little bit whether I'd done the right thing. We did it again later at a place called Monsoche, which was on the edge of what one might call our territory, a nice place on the edge of a lake. And we had a little bit of a battle down there.
This was an ambush, was it?
I don't really remember, but I remember we did quite well. I suppose it was an ambush, yes. The next day, they burnt every house in Monsoche. It was quite a little town, except for one. And everybody said, now we know who is working with the Germans. His house wasn't burnt. Now, whether that was true or not, one doesn't know. But it was ruined. The whole place was burnt. And there we are.
Were the SAS... Had the SAS gone off?
Well, yes, I'm sorry. The two SAS that were with us had gone off, and the rest of the SAS unit, so it was a company or something, I don't know what it was in size, had turned up, and they were off on their own. But I managed to fix them up with the local, with my local Mackie for rations and food, so that they didn't have to worry about, getting food and buying food and so on, or can't eat from here and there. I don't say that they didn't have food trouble, because we all had food trouble at times. There was a time when food was very, very short. And there was, I remember, one couple of days or 3 days or something, we had nothing but beans, which made our tummies rather uncomfortable. But